And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dodson.
During his 2024 State of Higher Education Address, Commissioner Chris Lowry reflected upon higher education policy as well as programmatic successes. This year's address focused on the Commission's collaborative efforts to improve college enrollment, completion, graduation retention, and research outcomes over the past 12 to 18 months. During the address, Commissioner Lowry outlined how the Commission is addressing the challenges and opportunities facing higher education in Indiana through the HOPE Agenda, Hoosier Opportunities and Possibilities Through Education. Additionally, he revisited recent legislative victories from the 2023 and the 2024 sessions and shared early indicators of those strategic initiatives. Commissioner Lowry, as you're crisscrossing the state sharing some of the highlights from your 2024 State of Higher Education Address, I thank you for joining us here at our Lakeshore Public Media Studios.
Dee, thank you for having me here. I'm just delighted to be with you today.
Commissioner Lowry, so you're in the region today spreading the gospel, if you will, following your 2024 State of Higher Education Address earlier this month. And I want to say, no pun intended, but you had a lot of good news to share with Hoosiers. I want to spend our time today going through a few of the updates as well as successes. But before we unpack a few highlights, take a moment to introduce yourself to our listening audience. And if you don't mind, include details regarding your role with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education.
Dee, thanks so much. Yes, my name is Chris Lowry, and I'm just barely 2 years into serving in this role. I have a background in higher education and in business and public policy. So, you know, this seemed like a great fit at this point in my career. I spent about 8 years with Ivy Tech Community College, actually stood up and then led their workforce side of the college there with President Sue Elsperman. Prior to that, I was in industry for 20 years, where I gained a lot of experiences, including workforce development. And prior to that, as my adult children would say, I was a policy wonk. They might just say a nerd. And so all of those things kind of come together here. But yeah, our role at the commission is to serve as the coordinating body for all of our public institutions, all seven of the public institutions and the regionals and so forth, and then to work very closely with our private institutions. In fact, today I'm going to be spending some time visiting with folks in up here in the region in higher education, but also to spend time with employers. I try to make a concerted effort to spend time with employers, folks in K-12, community and faith-based organizations. And our role at the commission, my ultimate responsibilities include helping to set the strategy for higher education in Indiana. And we also have management responsibility for our state's portfolio of need-based financial aid. It's about a $400 million portfolio, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. Again, last week, in your role as the commissioner with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, you gave an address, and reflections included the 2024 Indiana legislative session, and you highlighted a few early indicators of success. And going back for just a moment, in 2023, the commission announced its HOPE agenda to position Indiana as a top 10 state by 2030. Let's go through just a few of the improvements as part of the HOPE agenda, which outlines seven goals. Starting with college enrollment, Region policymaker State Representative Earl Harris Jr. authored House Enrolled Act 1449 during the 2023 Indiana legislative session, which now auto enrolls all 8th grade students into the 21st Century Scholars Program. Walk us through why this single piece of legislation will improve college enrollment and affordability.
You have literally hit on my favorite topic in my 2 years of having served in this role. Representative Harris, been a friend for a long time, and his leadership on this was just absolutely extraordinary. So I'll tie this together. 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago after I arrived, we started identifying and really pointing out, frankly, with a lot of noise, that our college going rate or enrollments, especially of high school seniors, had been declining. And it had been declining for a decade, down from about 68% to 53%. And to me, and then as we started talking about it, it was very alarming to folks. you know, and when you pull those numbers apart, it was even worse, if you will, that it was even more alarming when we looked at the fact, I think at that time, the college going rate was only 43% for black students, 44% for Hispanic students, 15 point difference between young men and young women, young men being lower, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. And then for low income students, it was 30%. However, low income students who were part of the 21st Century Scholars Program, only difference being that they had been brought into the 21st Century Scholars Program, you know, through high school, their college going rate is 81%. That's amazing, right?
Phenomenal.
Yeah, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Higher than almost any category other than a couple of really small categories of you know, students that have completed the Indiana College Corps and things like that. Mm-hmm. So really good success. Well, Representative Harris and I talked, and then we started talking with folks, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, policy leaders, et cetera. And as I was talking to our team, you know, I said, so tell me about where we are with 21st Century Scholars. And they said, hey, Chris, you know, it's been around for 30-some years, which I knew, but we were only getting about half the kids who are eligible enrolled.
Right.
And a child has to be enrolled by the end of their eighth grade year, which is technically June 30th of that school year. And so, you know, Representative Harris pushed this. We got, frankly, this was one of my favorite things about this, Dee. We had wide support from Democrats, from Republicans, from urban, from rural, from suburban. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've pointed to it several times beyond the most important thing about it, which is that a lot of kids are going to get helped now and right. get the opportunities that many of us have had. It also just showed to me a different spirit that we don't hear or see often enough in sort of a divisive time we have. Mm-hmm. So I'll set that aside. Maybe that's another topic for another interview someday, Dee.
Yeah. But
what we did was we made the case for it. You know, certainly there would be an increase in the expenditures, but we were only getting about half of the kids.
Right.
And the first time someone said to me, well, Chris, you know, here's what the additional expenditures will be. I said, you know, okay, that's interesting, but what you're not telling me is the rest of the equation. And so we did a return on investment analysis, and not really surprisingly, right, what we saw, very mm-hmm. conservatively estimated, is that over the life of these extra children who would be brought into this because they already qualified, their wages, just the difference in their wages over their lifetimes, would be more than 10% of our original investment.
Wow.
And the increase in tax receipts,
wow.
state and local, over that time would more than pay for the original investment, right? So this
wow.
this just became exactly wow,
yeah,
you know.
You don't I never considered that. That's
yeah.
interesting.
It was really breathtaking to us. Mm-hmm. And so to cut to the chase, it passed. I think it was unanimous or might have had a stray no vote here and there, maybe in a committee or something like that. But just it was widely embraced, and I think no one had really felt that, you know, we could gain momentum to do something like this. I didn't even know it had really been discussed other than just passing conversations over
right.
the years. But here's the impact. This is what has happened. So we have to enroll these children, these young people, by the time they're finished being eighth graders. In 2022, the year before this passed, we only enrolled about 20,000 students statewide. And that was less than half of the kids eligible.
Right.
In 2023, on June 30th, I literally have chills thinking about it and talking about it, every time I do, we enrolled over 46,000 kids. So from 20,000 the previous year to over 46,000
right.
the next year. And I mean, I literally think of this every day because there are young people who are going to have these opportunities. You know, during high school, if people are familiar with the 21st Century Scholars Program, they get support to be good students, good citizens, expectations like filing the FAFSA, having a college and career plan, keeping a minimum GPA, you know, just, you know, keeping your nose out of trouble. You know, like I say, good citizen, good student stuff. And then the promise of this is you will receive full tuition and some other fees to go to one of our public institutions, same level of funding if you go to a private. And what's so great about it is the ability then for the students to get other additional grants and scholarships that, you know, in most instances, it pays for everything, room,
right.
board, et cetera. So it's, you know, an economist had some writing on this not long after it passed. These are his words, not mine, but I think he may be right.
Mm-hmm.
He referred to it as the most significant piece of economic development legislation in the state of Indiana in over 50 years.
Yes.
And you know, I agree. It, you know, human development, human capital development, it's good for the person, it's good for employers, it's good for communities in our entire state. So it truly is one of the, it may be the best thing I've ever been involved in my now 40-year professional career.
One thing I think about regarding Hoosiers is this shift in changing careers, returning to school to level up, if you will. And one more goal from the HOPE agenda I would like to talk about is this priority for adult learners. Can you spend some time talking more about how adult learners can receive credit for prior learning?
Yeah, and I'm so glad, again, you pointed that out. And thank you for saying a few different times about the HOPE agenda. I have to say really quickly for your audience, it's an acronym. It stands for Hoosier Opportunities and Possibilities Through Education. And probably won't have time today, but there's so many documented facts that economically and socially people benefit from, you know, every increase of level of training and education, you know, from wages to unemployment to, frankly, life expectancy, infant mortality, you know, unemployment, labor participation rates, the whole nine yards. It just statistically improves with each level of training and education. So, you know, back to your question, though, about adults, we decided to place a very serious focus, along with enrollment and along with completions and then graduate retention. Two really key and interrelated areas that we decided to place focus on were getting more Hoosier adults back in the game, you know, whether they had had any training or education after a high school diploma, or even if they had some degree and then realized, oh, I need to know more about technology. That might be me as an example. I have somebody who's literally helping tutor me on AI because I don't know what I don't know. And so with this focus, we said, let's really put an emphasis on adults, including funding that's available, you know, grants and scholarships like our adult student grant, workforce ready grant, you know, and the like. But then also focus on some specific populations. We have chosen to focus on veterans and individuals in the military, those with disabilities, and the justice involved. The reality is, in each of those areas, they don't get as much attention as statistically they really need. In fact, less so than the broader adult population. And yet, the results when they receive training and education are really good. You know, vastly, they're great. You know, they're great employees, very focused, you know, want to do well, and so forth. So, coupling up to that, there has been something called credit for prior learning that's been around for a number of years, but frankly, not really leveraged, not leveraged in Indiana and only leveraged sparingly around the country. Credit for prior learning is, you know, to sort of simplify it, it is taking and quantifying what an individual has learned, what their knowledge is through any credit or through different forms of prior training or education and also work experiences. So I'll give you some examples. You know, in my instance, in 20 years in industry, we did a lot of different training, you know, including on lean manufacturing and human resources and strategy and so forth. And so that's an example where someone may have received training, you know, in their place of employment or maybe even formally, you know, a certification program, say in manufacturing, a certified production technician. But then also through their work experiences have learned, you know, a lot of what might otherwise be captured in curriculum and in a degree. So credit for prior learning helps an institution, higher ed institution, and then the individual quantify those things and say, hey, this will count for X number of hours with the college. So I'll use the one example. I mentioned certified production technician. It's a national thing, a certification that folks can get in the manufacturing environment. I think I've got this right, that transfers directly into Ivy Tech, I believe, for 9 credit hours toward, you know, different programs. That's amazing. That's, you know, that's 3 classes that someone then would not have to take.
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've pointed to a friend of mine who were almost the same age. In his instance, he and some relatives started a business about 40 years ago, about the time I was finishing my undergrad. He didn't go to traditional college. But over the years, he and his family built a business that employs about 1,500 people, about $250 million in revenue, you know, 2 or 3 states here in the U.S. They're also in Mexico. And he's literally like done everything in the company except be legal counsel and probably not CFO because they probably have had certified accountants, but literally has done all of that. Mm. And yet, the way it has been for years, if he just decided, hey, you know what, I want to get a business degree, he would show up and someone would say, here are the list of all the entry-level courses you need to take, Right. And the reality is he could probably run the department.
He could run.
Right.
Exactly.
Because he's done marketing and operations and logistics and transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a way of quantifying those work capabilities, various training. And up until just about a month and a half ago, only 8 states in the nation had essentially a strategic plan and framework to leverage credit for prior learning for adult learners, you know, going back to or continuing their education. Now Indiana is the 9th. Our team spent the better part of a year with our friends in the academia and employers and others forming this really great strategic plan and framework. And so we'll be, you know, pushing that out and implementing it with our partners in higher ed. And the long and the short of it is it helps an adult learner, you know, accelerate their end goal of that, you know, credential, that degree, and also in the process, obviously saving time, saving money, you know, quantifying their capabilities. So then they're that much more marketable in the workforce.
Now, Commissioner, I want to spend some time speaking about the Indiana pre-admission strategy. I'm so excited to talk about this because I understand that this new initiative will have a profound and proactive approach to college enrollment in the Hoosier State, beginning with the inaugural class of 2024. So can you spend some time just kind of unpacking what that is?
Hitting some of my favorite topics today, Dee. This all ties back to that enrollment goal we were talking about, right? We had seen such a precipitous decline. Other states had. Ours was just steeper than, well, any of us would like. So we started thinking about proven solutions and challenges that might exist for enrollment. And literally talking as a team one day, I know I made kind of a glib comment, but it really was how I felt, that you know, the broader marketplace for the consumer of higher education is challenging. You know, if you think about it, here you're likely to spend, whether of your own funds or, you know, grant and scholarship funds, et cetera, you're likely to spend tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you've got a few institutions in mind because, well, those are the ones you know about.
Right.
And so you don't know about all the other institutions that might be applicable. And then you go through this process of applying and all the stuff that goes with that, and then you wait. You literally wait to see, will they actually take me, and just to be blunt about it, my money,
right,
to do what I want to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we're having this conversation, and you know, very, we all agreed, you know, the marketplace just isn't really as consumer-friendly as it could be. Well, we started digging into it and said, how could we make it better? And as we were forming our ideas, we found out that the state of Idaho was doing something basically like what I'll explain in a second is our pre-admission strategy. We were the third in the nation to do this. Idaho, and I think Minnesota was second. Now we're the third, and others, by the way, others starting to follow us. essentially, what we've done is go to all the public and private institutions, and we did so very quickly for this year's cohort of students. We actually thought about launching this in August of 24, and my response to our team was, no, let's run. Let's don't look for perfect this year. Let's get as close as we can, but let's run. Mm-hmm. So we went to our public and privates and said, hey, you tell us, give us a threshold GPA and or SAT that would, you know, constitute admissions to your, you know, to your institution. And then we were able to work with the Department of Education and local schools to say, hey, now we need that data. Basically, all juniors in high school take the SAT. So got the scores right there.
The scores.
And now this coming year, we'll actually have all the GPAs because it's been, you know, put on an electronic platform.
Okay.
We actually went to all the high schools last year in a very, very short notice. And long story short, we captured about 80% of all of the higher ed institutions in Indiana and about 75% or 80% of the kids.
Wow.
Well, at this point, and of course, I'm not the, you know, tech genius at all. That's fortunately, we have really smart people who do that. You know, it's a matter of matching up the data, right? And so in September, we started sending for the very first time in Indiana letters to the homes, electronic communication and letters to the homes of every single, you know, of these high school students. Now, again, it was about 80% of them this year, around 57,000. This fall, this September, we'll send it to all seniors, and that's around 75,000. But the letter is pretty simple. You know, it said, hey, you know, it was congratulating them. And then it provided a list of every single public and private institution, and again, about 80% participated with us, to which you would be pre-admitted. And I got to tell you, I had no idea sort of what the reaction would be. And I pretty quickly found out. I was sitting in a meeting, I think, the first time something came through. And I don't know how to put it, my phone started to blow up. Text messages, calls, emails from people I didn't even know.
Wow.
Saying, this is amazing. The average student found out that she or he would be pre-admitted to 24 institutions in Indiana, schools they'd never heard of. So I think about up here, the folks I'm going to be visiting with today, you know, that say a kid in Southern Indiana suddenly learned about Purdue Northwest, or they learned about Calumet College, or they learned that these other places are there, and you know, by gosh, they would be admitted.
Right.
As many as 38 that participated, counting all the regionals. There were some students who actually found out 38. And just to find out then from parents and then some of the kids, I have people coming up all the time and saying, hey, the most recent one was one who said, hey, my kid was going to go to this school in Ohio. He's not going there now.
Right.
And told me the three that he had narrowed it down to right here in Indiana. So, right, it's keeping the talent here, making education more accessible, and then through 21st Century and our other grants and things, also making it more affordable.
Now, Commissioner, I want to shift for a moment and talk about the 2024 Indiana legislative session in regards to higher education. Are there any notes that you would like to share regarding the session in regards to higher education?
I would. And building off of some of those priorities, and again, thanks for mentioning, you know, some of those key goals in the HOPE agenda. But building off of some of those, we received, again, really broad support. There was one primary bill that contained four different things in it that the way I've been looking at it, you know, our ultimate goal is to improve educational attainment, you know, post the high school diploma, whatever training and education that might look like, because, again, economically and socially, the outcomes are just better. But you know, so improve the attainment for individuals. But in the process, our primary focus this year was on access and affordability. So building on things like the pre-admissions, 21st Century Scholar, the expansion we did of the 21st or of the Frank O'Bannon grant for low-income students and, you know, those various things. So four components to it. The first was to look at our Indiana College Corps. I'll make that really quick. The Indiana College Corps has been around about 12 years, and it's a block of 30 credit hours of dual credit that high school students can take. You know, and it came about because a lot of times what happens is students kind of collect what we think of as random acts of dual credit. And they're learning, obviously, and it's good that they're learning and so forth. But it's even more important to know that those can fully transfer to a college or university. And so this was created about 12 years ago. As a sidebar, when I came into the role about 2 years ago, I was stunned to find out that only about 84 of our high schools out of more than 500 in Indiana actually offered the full core. They would offer a lot of dual credit, but you know, getting it down to that. And the reason that's so important is, by law, that the public institutions have to fully accept that block of 30 hours. Well, that's a whole year's worth of college. And now many of our privates accept it because, well, it makes sense, right? The marketplace is working. And we put an immediate emphasis on that. And I challenged our team to move it up as quickly as possible toward at least 500. Well, that was April 2022. By August, now taking 10 years to get to 84, by August, we were up at 149.
Wow.
By this past August, we were up to 222. And by this coming August, we expect to be up around 300. Well, this bill takes it one step further, and it requires all high schools to either offer it or to report back to the commission on what the barriers are and what their plan of implementation would be. So it's such a gift to young people that if they can leave high school with this full year, they're more likely to enroll. They're much more likely to complete. And of course, I'm crossing my fingers, I hope they stay in Indiana then when they do.
No brain drain, right.
Yeah. So that was the first component. The second component is really interesting. It's called reverse transfer. I'll give you an example. Let's use Ivy Tech locally. If someone is pursuing, say, their associate degree, and then they transfer to, say, Purdue Northwest, but they don't finish their associate degree, say they've taken 45 hours out of 60 hours. They go ahead and transfer because they want to, and that's the next best step for them. However, when they are at, say, Purdue Northwest, and Purdue Northwest has just been such a great partner, maybe I'll say another four institution, if they complete the hours there that they would have at Ivy Tech, right, they would have what would on paper constitute an associate degree. So this puts in place a mechanism to do that reverse transfer. So for the four-year institution to essentially reverse those hours back to the two-year college so that student can get an associate degree. You know, sometimes people ask, so why is that important? Well, the fact of the matter is, even when someone, you know, transfers to that next level and says, hey, I'm going to go ahead and transfer even though I haven't completed this associate degree, many times they still don't complete and don't get their bachelor's degree.
Makes sense.
Right?
Makes
so sense. In this mm-hmm. instance, rather than transferring, not getting the bachelor's degree and not having anything, they have that associate degree. So again, yeah, it's just so logical. And this puts a mechanism in place for us just to broadly do that. The third element is really, I think, really interesting. We've got, you know, frankly, we've had national media calling us saying, hey, what are you doing with this? It's called Degree in Three. Purdue has done some of this. Ball State has. Others have. But right, it hasn't been a state priority. And what this does is it requires our state public institutions to look at their various programs and determine what degrees could possibly be done in 3 years rather than four.
That's a game changer.
Right?
That's
yeah. You reduce changer. The time, you reduce the money, you get into the marketplace sooner. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, every institution is going to report back and say, hey, here's how we're going to do it. Here are the ones we're going to do. And of course, we hope that you know, sort of the velocity increases and we'll be tracking it very closely that more and more will offer that. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't be a requirement for a student to do it in 3 years, but mm-hmm. rather an option that is very clearly defined of how to go do that. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is very similar to sort of that reverse transfer that I was describing in this context. We know that in spite of Indiana's completion rate, so going to and finishing college, while it's really been improving over the years, we're 11th best in the nation now. I'm pleased with that. Of course, I want us to be a top 10. But even while it's been improving, broadly, a lot of students still don't complete. And you know, and that's just a shame. If they started a four-year institution, you know, maybe get you know three-quarters of it done, and life gets in the way, right? A family member is sick. That individual gets sick. You know, a host of things we know are real life barriers. What this allows us to do is to work with the four-year institutions. We'll do a study to see what the advisability and feasibility would be for those four-year institutions to offer an associate degree. So it and where it would mostly apply is, you know, the student who says, again, hey, I'm going to go for my you know, bachelor's of science, life gets in the way, you know, they can't get back, mm-hmm. but yet they've done enough credits, 60 hours, mm-hmm. you know, to constitute an associate degree. And rather than them just leaving, you know, maybe with debt, no credential, mm-hmm. this challenges all of us to say, would it be advisable and really study this to look at that side of the equation? Sort of another bill, it wasn't exactly a companion bill, also does the opposite, not really the opposite, but also complements it. And that has us, along with our two-year institutions, especially Ivy Tech, to look at and say, you know, what's the advisability and feasibility of them offering certain four-year degrees? And especially in those applied science areas like some of the things in manufacturing or nursing where there's such an incredible high demand. So those last two, you know, we don't know what the outcome of that'll be, but it's the first time we've really made a pointed and concerted effort to look at it and say, you know, how could this possibly help students?
In the few minutes or so that we have left, I understand that the Indiana Commission on Higher Education has gone through a bit of restructuring and reorganization. Can you share with our listening audience what that is?
Yes, I would love to. And sort of this is, you know, sort of the backside of it. A couple of different things. We, as we launched this vision last year, we started following it immediately by what we refer to as a strategic management plan. So like, how do we go make this stuff happen? You know, honestly, I think too oftentimes in government and other places, big ideas are out there, but executing them, that's where things fall short. So we created this strategic management plan. It comes from industry and from private business, been developed by, you know, really world-renowned consultants, and we've adopted it. And it goes from our vision, the things you were talking about, to then the strategic goals and the HOPE agenda. Each one of those assigned to two senior associate commissioners, and then each initiative, and we talked about just a few here, go out to people within the organization. Ultimately, what we've done, and this has just been in this year, is each person, and we have a little over 60 people on our entire team across the state, each person now has at least three measurable goals for the year that relate back to one of those Hope Agenda goals. And, you know, part of it, yes, is about accountability, but also I've had the privilege of managing and leading people for a long time. It helps show people why they're there, that regardless of what they're doing, how it fits to the big goal, you know, and it feeds that passion. We've also realigned, we had a research team, really, you know, great work, but it often resulted in reports that were, you know, sort of stale data, and they, you know, mostly sat on a shelf. We reorganized that. We now have a business intelligence team, and we've moved from reports. You'll be seeing later this year an online, real-time updated dashboard for any Hoosier to access. I just don't want people who are, you know, mildly, you know, or who maybe have deep interest in this to get to this data and information. I want any Hoosier who wants to see it to see it, and maybe businesses and others who want to move to our state. So that is going to be coming online, and we're going to keep, because we need to, using some of the lagging data, because, you know, some of it comes out only like every, you know, it's like 2 years old when you get it. And that's very frustrating to me. So we're adding in things like leading indicators. You know, the college going rate is always a 2-year lag data, and that just makes me crazy. So that's why we're using the enrollment now too. By the way, I should mention this, first time in 13 years, enrollment was up this school year for colleges and universities in Indiana. 13 years, so awesome. We're pleased with that.
Yes.
And then we're beginning to forecast on all of these initiatives. So our fellow Hoosiers for whom we work will know, are these things working? Where are we on track? Where are we off track? And then the last thing is, I just have to tell you this, we started about a year ago implementing something we call the Partnership Pentagon. We went to leaders in 5 areas of our broad society and said, we want your help. We want you to push us, pull us, tell us to move faster, tell us what we ought to be looking at. And so they're from 5 areas: government, education, business, nonprofit organizations, and specifically some I've mentioned today, community and faith-based organizations, and then philanthropy. Each of those areas is just, they're just so fundamental to civil society. And even beyond that, you know, I am absolutely convinced when each one of those 5 is working in concert, you know, it's not a total of 5 at the end. It's something much, much more, right? It's something that's much more exponential when they come together. And we've been seeing that. They've been advising us. They're going to issue a report this summer of how to build on the Hope Agenda. And so we're eager for that. And then we're also doing a consumer study, the deepest one that's ever been done regarding higher ed on consumers here in Indiana. We'll also issue that this summer.
That is so exciting. You know, I could spend an additional hour speaking to you because, again, there's so much information to be shared from your office. And so I'm so excited that you're in the region today. So excited that you stopped by our studio. And I know that this will be probably the first of many conversations that we will have about all of the exciting news coming from your commission. So I thank you for swinging by Lakeshore Public Media Studios, and I look forward to having you again.
And I can't thank you enough. And I too hope this is only the first of our conversations.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics recently released the June jobs report, showing 206,000 jobs were added, down from 208,000 in April. The slowing job growth, in combination with a slowing inflation, bolsters optimism that the Fed could cut interest rates in September. Joining us now with the latest economic outlook is Ersheng Leong, an economist with PNC Financial Services Group. Ersheng, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Dee. Thanks for having me again.
So as always, we got the jobs report. So can we talk about payroll numbers first? What are some highlights there?
We got the jobs report this morning, and so this jobs report, the June jobs report, shows the U.S. labor market is cooling down. But this is exactly what the Federal Reserve wants to see, you know, with slowing job growth and wage growth. So the U.S. economy added 206,000 jobs in June, so that came in with downward revisions to job growth in previous 2 months. If you look at the details, you see, you know, private sector added 136,000 jobs in June, with government employment growth somewhat. But the private sector job growth has slowed this year, with average gains over the past 3 months down from the average of all of last year. But that being said, the share of employment in the private sector is still higher than it was before the pandemic. And besides the job gains, you know, we had the unemployment rate rose slightly in June. So the unemployment rate, you know, is still historically low, and it's up from the decades-long low of 3.4% in early last year and from 3.7% in early 2024, but it is still low. And besides unemployment rate, we see the labor force, you know, the number of adults either working or looking for jobs, that increased by a larger 277,000 in June. So the unemployment rose even with more people reporting they were working. So besides, you know, unemployment rate, with job gains, we also got some numbers on wage growth. So we see wage growth slowed in June, although it is still running a bit hot for the Fed's inflation objective. You know, average hourly earnings increased in June, but slowed from 0.4% growth in May. And the wage growth over the past year has slowed to 3.9%. But ideally, we want that to be around 3.5%. So it's still running a bit hot for the Federal Reserve's inflation objective. You know, wage growth was almost 6% in early 2022, as, you know, labor shortage was more of a problem at that time. And now it is gradually easing as the labor market continues to normalize after the pandemic. And I know, you know, Indiana, a state, is manufacturing heavy. We saw actually the manufacturing employment fell by 8,000 as high interest rate remains a drag, you know. You know, in the near term, high interest will continue to be a drag on the manufacturing sector. And PNC does expect the 2 interest rate cuts in the Fed funds rate again late this year. So that will be some relief for the manufacturing sector as well as for the Indiana state. And, you know, the June jobs report came out this morning. That confirms the U.S. labor market is softening this year, but remains very good. So job growth is going to a more sustainable long-run pace, and unemployment rate is rising, but it's still very low, indicating a bit more slack, and wage growth continues to ease. And this jobs report supports PNC's forecast for interest rate cuts at the end of this year, and two cuts. And in fact, we are not ruling out the possibility of a rate cut in September. So we are closely monitoring, you know, incoming data on inflation and the labor market.
Let me shift for a moment. So I know we talked about PNC's expectations on the FOMC's rate decision, but we haven't had a chance to talk about the June FOMC decision and the updates that are there. The dot plot from this FOMC meeting was also updated from the one in March. What are some key takeaways there? Are they in line with PNC's expectations?
Yeah, actually, we got the FOMC June meeting minutes this week, and but largely as expected, you know, the FOMC kept the Fed funds rate unchanged in its policy statement in June. But you know, the dot plot was not released in every meeting, and in fact, prior to the June dot plot was the March one. And in this dot plot, the most recent one shows little progress in reducing core PCE inflation this year. There was little change in the dot plot relative to March for the medium forecast for GDP growth and the unemployment rate. But there was a bit of surprise in the inflation forecast. In particular, the median participant expected the core personal consumption expenditure price index to be at 2.8% at the end of this year. So that was up from 2.6% in March dot plot. And similarly, the overall PCE inflation at the end of this year was 2.6% in the dot plot, in June's dot plot, compared to 2.4% in March projections. So this occurred despite a slowing in inflation in April and in CPI inflation in April and May. So the dot plot suggests really no further progress in slowing core inflation through the rest of the year. Well, PNC's June interest rate forecast is still for 225 basis point cuts this year at the FOMC's November and December meetings. So our forecast assumes that inflation gradually eases this year due to a combination of slower housing inflation and a reduction in inflationary wage pressures with a slight softening in the labor market. But consumers are expected to stay in a good shape.
Great, great. Now, Orshang, before I let you go, so we're coming off the heels of the 4th of July weekend. It's a big travel weekend, and by all accounts, the recent travel numbers are through the roof. And it looks like consumers are quite positive at this point. So what are some recent signs that PNC Financial Services are seeing from consumers, like perhaps consumer spending? And to that point, can you talk about what you are seeing in consumer updates?
Yeah, it's just past the Independence Day. So we think that consumers are in general still in good shape. In fact, the jobs report we got reports that consumer spending will grow. And well, job growth is slowing from this job report, but it remains positive, and wages continue to increase faster than prices. So So the current economic expansion will likely continue. And in fact, incomes were up in May, consumer spending increased, but more slowly than incomes. If you look at the details, nominal personal income increased solidly in May. Disposable, you know, after-tax personal income was also up in May. And real inflation-adjusted after-tax income also jumped in May. So consumer spending was rising at a solid pace, but more slowly than incomes. You know, that will lead to an increase in the saving rate. This is important. Something I want to point out is if you look at the historical data for the personal saving rate, right now it is at a relatively low level. It's lower than its pre-pandemic level, so people may be concerned, but it's still higher than its level before the Great Recession. And in fact, based on the jobs report this morning, consumer spending was rising at a solid pace, but more slowly than income. So that will lead to an increase in the saving rate. And there was a nice increase in personal income powered by solid job growth and wage gains back in May's personal income analyst report from the BA. So the labor market remains historically strong. That will continue to support consumer spending in the near term. We expect income growth to continue through the rest of this year as job and wage growth continue, although at a slower pace than in recent months. This, in turn, will support increasing consumer spending and other positives for consumers, including, you know, slowing inflation, rising household wealth with higher stock prices and home values, and generally solid balance sheet. But one thing I want to point out is that, you know, right now interest rates are still very high, and there is a need to increase savings, as that will help buffer any incoming negative economic shocks, you know, just in case. But spending will continue to rise in the near term at a slower pace than income, with household spending rising through the rest of this year at a slower pace. Overall economic growth will slow somewhat this year, but there will not be a recession. Good consumer fundamentals will support economic expansion into next year.
As always, you always leave us with a great point. And I will say that my takeaway from all of the information that you shared with us today on Lakeshore Public Media is that there will not be a recession. And so I'm certain that that is something that all of our listeners love to hear. And so again, Ersheng, I thank you for joining us monthly with an economic outlook locally, statewide, as well as nationally from the PNC Financial Services Group. And we look forward to having you back with us next month.
All right. Thanks for having me again, Dee. See you next time.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. According to the 2024 Kids Count Data Book, a comprehensive 50-state annual report by the Annie E. Casey Foundation offering national rankings on various indicators of child well-being, Indiana ranked 27th overall. While progress has been made in supporting our kids in some areas and excel in others, the report shows Indiana having a number of indicators with room for improvement. Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman joins us now to discuss her latest column, which unpacks some of this data. Tammy, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
It is great to be with you, Dee. Always a pleasure.
Tammy, earlier this year, Indiana Youth Institute, in partnership with the Commission on Improving the Status of Children in Indiana, released the 2024 Kids Count Data Book. And you're here with us today to talk about the National Kids Count Data Book. Now, in your latest column regarding this report, you share that Indiana's child well-being is a mixed bag. And we'll share a few takeaways from the national report shortly. But for those that may be unfamiliar, please share what the Kids Count Data Book is.
Yes, that's a great question. So every year, Indiana Youth Institute, every year for I think just over 30 years, we've been compiling data on how our kids are doing. Everything from economic well-being to education to health, all these various factors. And we are part of a national network. So Indiana's, there's an IYI in every state that's doing the same thing. So we publish our state-specific book usually around February, and then it goes into this whole national network. And then in June, late June, usually this time of year, summertime, they release the national rankings. So this really takes all of Indiana's data, compares it against the states, both our surrounding states, our neighboring states, and the national overall well-being of kids, so that we can kind of get a sense of how Indiana's kids are doing compared to national averages and other states.
Tammy, the 2023-2024 school year ended about a month ago, and our students received their final report card.
you share in your latest column, which can be found at IYI.org, that the Kids Count Data Book is a report card of sorts on child well-being. What are a few of the bright spots from the report, both locally as well as nationally?
So how our kids are doing, it's really something to tell adults how we're doing to care in caring for our kids. That's why we call it a report card for adults, right? So it's saying to us, 27th in the country is a little lower than half, right? We're at 50 states, 27th, you know, that isn't our highest ranking. We've fallen a couple of spots this year. And so we need to be looking at it and saying, what are we doing well? And what do we need to be doing a little bit differently? For the bright spots this year, again, if we're looking at it kind of like that report card, the bright spot for Hoosier Kids was parental employment. So many, many of our parents had secure full-time employment, which was higher than both the national average and that of surrounding states, you know, particularly Illinois, Kentucky, Michigan, and Ohio. Our housing costs in Indiana comparatively are still pretty modest. And then teen engagement, the percentage of kids that were enrolled and employed and or employed were also up. That's great. In addition, only 5% of Indiana children did not have health insurance, which is one of those indicators of overall well-being, because we know that kids that do have health insurance get preventative care more frequently than kids without it.
Tammy, I want to pivot for a minute, and I want to talk about some of the areas for improvement. So we all know, as noted in this report, that not surprisingly, post-COVID-19 pandemic, the educational challenges, the learning loss, right? And a point of interest in your latest column was a quote from Lisa Hamilton, the president and CEO of the NEE Casey Foundation. And it makes a point that I don't think is discussed enough in relationship to student classroom performance at optimal levels. And that is access to resources like tutoring, and we've talked about mental well-being quite often. So I want to ask you, is that why Indiana Youth Institute works so hard to advocate for the well-being of all Hoosier youth?
Absolutely. You know, we want to make sure that every single Hoosier student and every single Hoosier child can reach their full potential. And in order to do that, they need all these various factors come together to support their education and their health and their growth and their exploration and all of these things, helping them build a path forward, come together. So it is very important that we assess all the data, that we know the facts, so that as we're making decisions on do we need to invest more and spend more time and energy with after-school tutoring, or maybe it's summer school, or maybe it's a mix of both of those when we're trying to, in this case, perhaps move the needle on literacy. It is important to know where we're starting from so that we can see what works best for our kids.
Tammy, the report also notes the economic impact of this educational deficit and how profound it is. Speak more about the potential losses to the U.S. economy.
Yes, we know that kids that have trouble in reading, math, digital problem solving, all of those things, all of those skills are really important for today's particularly competitive global economy. And so as our kids, if our kids fall behind, it can quantify to up to potential losses. This is a huge number of $31 trillion in U.S. economic activity. So again, this is it. Of course, we want to pay attention to this information to care for each and every child. We also need to be thinking about it for our individual communities as well as our national economy.
Finally, Tammy, in the few minutes that we have left together today, in your latest column, you note the Annie E. Casey Foundation recommends several measures to improve student outcomes. Can you highlight a few?
Sure. So some of those things, again, in order for kids to learn in the classroom, they need to have healthy food. So ensuring access to low or no cost meal, reliable internet connections, also important. Place to study, time with friends, supportive teachers and counselors, always important. We're talking a little bit and learning more about access to intensive tutoring to help with some of those catch up or some of those issues that kids might need some help with. And then making sure that we are addressing chronic absenteeism, because we do know there's a compounding effect there. So even if it's early years and you think a day or 2 years might not matter all that much, it really does. It really does build up. And we want to make sure kids are in school so that they can learn all the things that our wonderful teachers are prepared to help them learn.
Tammy, as always, I thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking, sharing all of the information that all of the work that your organization, Indiana Youth Institute, does for all Hoosiers. And I can't wait to talk to you next month.
Sounds great, T, and thank you so much for caring about our kids.
Indiana Youth Institute is Indiana's member of the Kids Count National Network. For more information, visit www.iyi.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests from the Indiana Commission on Higher Education, Chris Lowry, from Indiana Youth Institute, President and CEO Tammy Silverman, and from PNC Financial Services Group, Ersheng Leong. And we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.